This episode of Swindled may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
34 million adults suffer from chronic pain. 50 million workdays are lost each year due to chronic pain. Chronic pain can lead to physiologic damage, emotional distress, functional impairments, inability to participate in rehabilitation, and inability to work. In this program, these and other patients, all of whom have suffered through years of varying degrees of chronic pain, tell the story of their long, often frustrating, always painful search for adequate treatment.
Every story about America's opioid epidemic starts here. December 1995, when Purdue Pharma, a modest family-owned company based in Stamford, Connecticut, won FDA approval for OxyContin, an extended-release oxycodone pill designed to replace its aging flagship morphine-based product soon after its patent expired. The active ingredient was not new. Oxycodone, derived from the same poppy plant that produces opium for morphine, has been approved for medical use in the United States since 1939. For decades, it was commonly combined with aspirin or acetaminophen and sold under brand names like Percocet and Percodan to treat moderate to severe pain. In its purest form, oxycodone was largely reserved for cancer patients and those in end-of-life care, prescribed to block pain receptors and make one's final days more tolerable. At high doses, the semi-synthetic opioid produces an intense sense of euphoria, one for which most earthly pleasures simply cannot compare. That's why oxycodone is so physically and psychologically addictive, experts say. And that's why for decades, medical professionals knew better than to prescribe it as a long-term treatment for pain, even though it was incredibly effective. Purdue Pharma intended to challenge that consensus.
We had a product that had tremendous potential. For 100 years, and even today, there is no drug that is more effective or safer than opioids for treating pain over the long term.
The company's new OxyContin pill would redefine pain management. Unlike short-acting opioids that required constant dosing, OxyContin was a 12-hour controlled-release tablet, just one pill twice a day, for smooth and sustained pain control. Patients, Purdue said, could finally sleep through the night without the dreaded clock watching. Another supposed advantage of OxyContin's delayed absorption, according to Purdue, was that it reduced the drug's potential for abuse by eliminating dependencies as well as the euphoric buzz associated with strong doses. As a result, the company announced, pain could now be treated indefinitely with narcotics and across a far broader range of conditions than ever before. Not just cancer, but back pain, arthritis, migraines, and knee injuries, ideal for sports medicine, dentistry, and even pediatrics. The company was no longer targeting a niche population of terminal patients, but a vastly expanded and highly profitable market that included anyone suffering from lingering discomfort. There was only one problem. Purdue's claims did not hold up. The company's own early unpublished studies of OxyContin showed that the drug's effects rarely lasted a full 12 hours, sometimes wearing off in as little as 8. When that happened, patients were left not only with the return of their underlying pain, but with the added distress of opioid withdrawal. Purdue was aware of this. So was the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Yet, in late 1995, OxyContin was approved and labeled as a 12-hour medication without any long-term studies or assessments of its addictive capabilities. That approval was overseen by FDA Medical Review Officer Dr. Curtis Wright, who reportedly met privately with Purdue executives in a hotel room in the days before the decision and permitted the company to help draft critical portions of its own application review. Less than 2 years later, Dr. Wright left the FDA to accept a lucrative position at Purdue Pharma.
You know you make me want to sell OxyContin. Here we go.
At Purdue's launch party for OxyContin in 1996, the company's president and co-chairman, Richard Sackler, the son of one of Purdue's three founding brothers, addressed his audience of employees. He had just returned from a journey high in the Himalayas, he told them, where he encountered, quote, the Wise One. According to Sackler, this mystical figure had delivered a prophecy. The launch of OxyContin tablets would be followed by a blizzard of prescriptions that will bury the competition, quote, a blizzard so deep, dense, and white that you will never see their white flag. What followed was one of the most aggressive pharmaceutical marketing campaigns in American history. Purdue modeled its strategy on the blueprint pioneered decades earlier by Richard Sackler's uncle, Arthur Sackler, who had famously transformed Valium into the industry's first $100 million blockbuster in the 1970s. Using that playbook, Purdue spent more than $207 million promoting OxyContin and doubled the size of its sales force, dispatching representatives to rural communities and mining towns with high rates of workplace injury. Doctors, pharmacists, and nurses were flown to all-expenses-paid pain management conferences where they were recruited, trained, and paid to promote the drug to their peers. Promotional videos featuring testimonials from patients whose lives had supposedly been transformed by OxyContin were shipped to tens of thousands of medical offices across the country. They arrived alongside stacks of starter coupons and boxes of swag, hats, pens, and even coffee mugs that revealed a hidden slogan when heated. It read, OxyContin, a step in the right direction.
It felt like somebody had an ice pick all the time, gouging right down in my backbone, just wiggling all the time.
Since I've been on this new pain medication, I have not missed one day of work.
The brand name is OxyContin.
Another thing, especially about the OxyContin, is that I feel like a real participant again.
It was all about selling the narrative. Pain, Purdue insisted, was dangerously undertreated. Opioids were safe. Addiction was rare. Life could be bearable again. To spread this message, the company set out to build what it referred to internally as a pain movement. Purdue partnered with competitors, most notably Johnson & Johnson, and together they financed advocacy organizations such as the American Pain Foundation and the American Pain Society, which fiercely supported the aggressive treatment of pain with opioid medications like OxyContin, as long as it was taken as prescribed. Opioids are the best, strongest pain medications and should be used much more than they are for patients in pain. The potential for becoming addicted to a prescribed opioid is very, very small. In fact, less than 1% of patients taking opioids actually become addicted. A marketing campaign, as cynical as it was deceitful. Nothing demonstrated that fact more than a concept Purdue pushed called pseudo-addiction, in which a patient looks, sounds, behaves, and craves like an addict, but only because their pain isn't being treated sufficiently.
Pseudo-addiction is a term that refers to behaviors that could be mistaken for true addiction, but are really just signs that you're not experiencing an adequate level of pain control.
According to Dr. J. David Haddix, Purdue's vice president of health policy and the physician who coined the term, the cure for pseudo-addiction was simple. More opioids. Imagine that. The consequences of Purdue's campaign of misinformation were swift and predictable. After OxyContin entered the market, opioid prescriptions for non-cancer pain surged from roughly 670,000 to 6.2 million in just 5 years. Places like West Virginia and Kentucky soon became saturated with what was known on the street as hillbilly heroin. Users learned they could defeat OxyContin's 12-hour time-release mechanism simply by crushing the pills and snorting them, delivering the full dose at once. Where that idea originated remains unclear. OxyContin's FDA-approved label explicitly warned, do not crush or snort these tablets, or else risk a dangerous and rapid release of pure oxycodone into your system that would result in the best fucking high of your life. I'm paraphrasing. Unsurprisingly, people began dying with OxyContin in their bloodstreams, from overdoses, from accidents, by the thousands, including several who had been featured in Purdue's original marketing video for the drug, like Johnny the Ice Pick Sullivan, who fell asleep and flipped his truck while driving under the influence.
It's like somebody standing there gouging all the time. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It could have been far worse, Richard Sackler wrote in 2001, after learning that 59 people had died from OxyContin in a single state. That remark captured the callousness at the heart of the Sackler family's refusal to accept even a sliver of responsibility. Internal emails later exposed how Purdue executives chose to respond to the growing body count, not with concern, but with blame. "We have to hammer on the abusers in every way possible," Sackler wrote. "They are the culprits and the problem. They are the reckless criminals." In another message, referring to his customers addicted to his product, he asked, "Why should they be entitled to our sympathies?" Despite mounting evidence of harm and culpability, Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family had no intention of slowing the sale or production of what had become the best-selling brand-name controlled substance in the United States, nor did the federal government stand in their way. Year after year, the Drug Enforcement Administration approved every production increase Purdue requested. Within a decade, the amount of oxycodone manufactured and cleared for sale had multiplied nearly 20-fold, and the FDA and the DEA weren't the only federal agencies that, through incompetence or corruption, squandered opportunities to confront the rapidly growing opioid crisis.
We had a problem. We had death rates, we had reports from medical examiners, we had crime rates going up in certain parts of our community. We had an explosion of OxyContin availability in our community. And so all of those things led us to believe that we needed to take a look at this issue. Once you had these millions of records, these investigators and lawyers pieced together a case. And then when you put it all together, it equals a crime.
After a multi-year investigation, federal prosecutors in the Western District of Virginia determined in 2006 that they had assembled enough evidence to charge Purdue Pharma executives with multiple felony counts, including wire fraud and money laundering, for deliberately inflating profits through deceptive and illegal practices. All of the potential charges were outlined in a 6-page document titled Proposed Indictment of Purdue Pharma. The memo circulated among senior officials in the Justice Department's fraud division. Had the case moved forward, it could have sent Purdue executives to prison and forced the company out of business. Maybe an entire nationwide crisis could have been averted. Instead, America's mayor stepped in.
Far from apologizing, Purdue Pharma is fighting back, saying its only intent is to get relief to the 50 million Americans in pain.
Well, we've been working with Purdue for about 4 months now.
Seen here in a company-provided news release, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani has agreed to lend his considerable credibility to the drug maker's battle to save its bestseller.
With Rudy Giuliani in their back pocket, Purdue's legal team bypassed line prosecutors and appealed directly to senior officials in the George W. Bush Justice Department. The case was quietly dismantled. Instead of facing trial for fraud and other felony charges, Purdue Pharma was permitted to plead guilty to a lesser offense, misleading the public and federal regulators about OxyContin's risk of addiction and potential for abuse. The company was fined $600 million, a fraction of the profits it had already made. In addition, three Purdue Pharma executives, none of them Sacklers, pleaded guilty to misdemeanor misbranding charges. They were collectively fined $34.5 million. No one went to prison.
Good evening. The maker of a hugely popular painkiller has some pain of its own tonight. The company and its top officers will pay $634 million in fines for lying to the public.
The Justice Department celebrated the settlement as a victory. In reality, it fell far short of the felony charges federal prosecutors had originally pursued. It was another missed opportunity to hold accountable the architects of a pharmaceutical massacre already spiraling out of control. And we know what happens next. An everlasting plague, more than 700,000 deaths, thousands of lawsuits, decades of litigation, tens of billions of dollars in profit for Purdue Pharma, and to this day, no criminal or personal accountability for the Sacklers, one of the wealthiest families in America.
Do you have any experience, any guilt from living off the proceeds, at least in part, of the sale of OxyContin?
No.
Do you believe that Purdue bears any responsibility for the opioid crisis in this country?
No.
A decade of regulatory failure and corporate greed cleared the runway for the opioid epidemic. Under mounting pressure, Purdue eventually reformulated OxyContin to make the pills harder to crush and less effective when abused. But the damage was already done. Years of prosecutorial inaction had emboldened competitors who rushed in to fill the gap with even more problematic alternatives, cheaper, easier to abuse, and tailored to a public that had already acquired a powerful appetite. Nowhere was this exploitation more evident than in Florida. A unique combination of permissive laws and lax oversight turned the state into ground zero for opioid distribution. There, two meathead twin brothers would pioneer a new business model, one that industrialized pain treatment and converted human dependency and desperation into revenue. Why? Because if they hadn't, someone else would have. The rise and fall of the blueprint for America's modern pill mill on this episode of Swindled.
They bribed government officials, clear violations of federal and state law, pay to play millions of taxpayer dollars that were wasted, paid tens of millions of dollars, $1 billion.
Falsifying its books and records,
responsible for the collapse of the entire system.
And in the role of some kind of swindler, is that right?
So our contractor this week is John George and his wife Aileen, and they're with Majestic Homes. These guys are a local builder that are awesome at what they do. They're really good people. They heard about Dunson's story, and they really wanted to help.
We have a great team here building this house. We have the best we can find. We're going to deliver a beautiful home to this family, and we're going to do what we're here for.
When Majestic Homes was featured on ABC's Extreme Makeover Home Edition in 2006, the company's public image concealed a business already unraveling. Florida's collapsing real estate market, it would soon become clear, was the canary in the coal mine for a national housing bubble. Clients reported waiting months, sometimes indefinitely, for construction on their homes to even begin. The owner of Majestic Homes, John Paul George, told the local newspaper that his company was a victim too. They were sitting on tens of thousands of dollars of unpaid invoices because buyers were breaking their contracts. The unbuilt homes were depreciating so rapidly that people were getting cold feet. That insecurity trickled down, and now Majestic Homes, which had been in business since 1984, was on the verge of bankruptcy. Soon, everyone on Majestic's payroll would be forced to find another way to make ends meet, including John George's twin sons, Chris and Jeff, who, as it happened, already had a lucrative side hustle. Chris and Jeff George were no strangers to trouble. Hyper-competitive and rambunctious from an early age, the twins made a sport of tormenting their ultra-wealthy enclave of Wellington, Florida, brawling with neighborhood kids at the hockey rink, building homemade acid bombs and fireworks, creating chaos whenever boredom struck. By the time they turned 20, both boys had lengthy rap sheets. Jeff had been charged with dealing in stolen property, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest with violence. Chris had stolen a police officer's motorcycle because, as he later explained, it was just sitting there. None of it really ever stuck, though. It seemed as if there was nothing their father's money couldn't make disappear. Until February 2003, that's when Chris George pleaded guilty to felony drug possession after customs agents caught him picking up a package of anabolic steroids he had ordered online from Yugoslavia. Getting juiced and pumping iron were favored pastimes among the George brothers and their friends. But this time, it came with consequences. Chris spent several months in the Palm Beach County Jail, an experience that changed him. At 23 years old, Chris George had learned a valuable lesson.
I was on probation for steroids, and I'm like, man, I gotta do this legally somehow. So I found some dentist that would prescribe it to me online. And so I got him like that for a while. And then I was like, you know what? I should open up a place that just does this. So that's what I did. And we started the steroid clinic, me and my brother, my twin brother.
In 2006, while still working in construction, the George brothers launched South Beach Rejuvenation, a telemedicine clinic that functioned largely as a front for selling legal steroids. Customers completed online questionnaires, and a doctor working remotely from his home approved prescriptions sight unseen for $5,000 per week. When he wasn't available, clinic employees, mostly Jeff and Chris's tribal tattooed, affliction shirt wearing buddies, simply forged his signature. Word spread quickly. Ads in bodybuilding magazines and gym locker rooms brought in a steady stream of customers. By the end of its first year, South Beach Rejuvenation was generating nearly $1 million in annual revenue. In 2007, the brothers opened a second location. That's where they met a physician known to local police as the Candyman. His real name was William Overstreet. One day, Overstreet made a suggestion. You know, if you guys want to make some real money, you should sell pain pills too. Pain pills? The twins asked, dumbfounded. Yeah, you know, Oxys, Roxys, Blues, Greenies, Perks. The brothers were many things, but drug users they were not. Listen, there's huge demand for this stuff, Overstreet told them. And with my DEA registration number, I can order it straight from the source. You lease the office space, you manage the business. I'll prescribe the drugs. We split the profits, 50-50. It was a simple proposal. The George brothers agreed to open multiple pain clinics along Florida's East Coast. Chris made the first move.
And I said, okay, well, I'll get an office. It didn't cost much. I rent an office for like $10,000, you know, with first class security. I built it out myself, a simple little build out. And we started that business. This was that one doctor, me, and my girlfriend at the time.
Chris George found a small, single-story bungalow outside of Fort Lauderdale on Oakland Park Boulevard, wedged between pawn shops and laundromats, just steps from a Christian radio station. In the parking lot, he planted a large red and white sign that read simply, Pain Clinic. Decals on the windows promised pain management, testosterone, weight loss, HGH, walk-ins welcome. South Florida Pain Clinic officially opened for business in February 2008. Patients paid $200 per visit, cash or credit. Insurance was not accepted. After checking in, they filled out intake forms that Chris had stolen from another clinic. He just swapped out the letterhead. The patients were then ushered into an exam room with Dr. William Overstreet for a 5 to 10 minute consultation. The visit usually ended the same way. A prescription for 240 30 milligram oxycodone tablets, the maximum Overstreet believed he could write without drawing attention from the DEA. The patient would return to the front desk and pay an additional $400 to $700 for the medication. The prescription was filled immediately on site. Chris's girlfriend, Diana Pavnik, an exotic dancer turned receptionist and untrained pharmacist, retrieved the pills from a gun safe hidden in a closet, handed them across the counter, and scheduled a follow-up appointment for 28 days later. Every step of this process was completely legal in the Sunshine State, under a doctor's supervision. South Florida Pain Clinic had become a one-stop shop prescription opioid distribution factory. Business was booming from the moment they opened the doors.
Like the first day we saw like six patients, which was a lot. You know, I didn't think it was going to be that many. You know, for a little while it was like six. The next day was like 12. Then it went to like 20. Like it grew like exponentially so quick. I mean, it got out of control right away.
The waiting room of South Florida Pain was filled with people who looked worn down and volatile, rough around the edges, impatient, unpredictable. Chris didn't dare leave or even step outside with Diana alone behind the counter. He needed backup. Someone who could impose order if the room turned hostile. Someone who could project authority without saying much at all. Chris knew exactly who to call.
When I was four, my mother didn't come home one night. At 1 o'clock in the morning, my father and I went looking for her because she was a bartender. The bar was closed. There was two ways to get there. It was like a circle. So he loaded me up in a truck and we went left to complete the circle. Hit the bar, didn't see her car there. On the other part of the circle, on the way back to the house, saw her car in a driveway. We parked down the road, walked up, looked into the window of the living room, and she was having sex with a guy in the living room.
Derek Nolan was 4 years old on September 12th, 1981, the day he witnessed his father kill his mother. His parents, Robert and Margaret Nolan, had separated but were reportedly considering reconciliation. Then one night, Margaret didn't come home. In the early morning hours, Robert drove through Liberty, New York with young Derek in the car, searching for her. They eventually found her vehicle parked outside the home of Bob Kelly, the owner of Bum and Kel's Bar and Restaurant, where Margaret worked. According to Derek, his father parked down the street and carried him toward the house. Robert peeked through a window and saw Margaret having sex with Bob, on the living room sofa. Moments later, Robert Dolan burst through the screen door. "Oh shit," Margaret gasped as she ran toward the kitchen. "Oh shit is right," Robert told her before a struggle ensued. Bob Kelly fled the house, but Robert chased him into the driveway, holding the buck knife he had used earlier in the day during a fishing trip with his son. "Don't kill him," Margaret pleaded. "Kill me instead." "Don't worry, bitch. You're next," Robert promised, before stabbing Bob 58 times to death in his driveway. Derek, who was being comforted by the family dog at the time, doesn't remember many details of what happened next. He recalls hearing screams and then silence. In a later interview with Matthew Cox, Derek said he just remembers standing over his mother, who was lying in a pool of blood, unable to wake her up.
And then that's pretty much all I remember.
Robert Nolan turned himself into police the next day. At his trial, the 34-year-old insulation contractor claimed that he had been driven temporarily insane after discovering his wife with another man. The Sullivan County jury was unable to reach a verdict, resulting in a mistrial. In a second trial in 1984, Robert Nolan was acquitted of aggravated manslaughter by reason of temporary insanity, but was not ordered to undergo psychiatric treatment. 17 years later, Robert Nolan murdered his second wife by shooting her at point-blank range in a walk-in closet before turning the gun on himself. By then, Derek Nolan, raised by his aunt and uncle, had finished high school and moved to Florida to attend West Palm Beach State College. He never completed his degree because he had found steady work as a warehouse manager for a plumbing company and was making real money. Everything a 20-year-old could want, Derek told Matthew Cox. A few years later, Derek started working for Majestic Homes. That's where he met the George brothers. Chris and Jeff were just like Derek, grown-up children with lots of money and steroid-enhanced muscle, who loved strippers, fighting, and blowing shit up. They became fast friends. But the good times didn't last. In January 2008, Derek was arrested for driving with a suspended license and lost his job at Majestic, which was on its last legs anyway. But as a 29-year-old felon, his options were slim. Fortunately, Derek's phone rang. It was Chris George, asking for help renovating a building for a medical clinic he was about to open. "What are you talking about?" Derek asked. "Can you even do that? You're not a doctor." "Of course," said Chris. "You don't need a license or anything."
Chris's actual explanation to me was, "Listen, how many doctors own Wellington Regional Hospital?"
"None."
"No doctors. It's a corporation that owns it, and the doctors answer to them. And there's a board that makes medical decisions." And he's like, "Well, I'll hire a medical director."
"Right.
You'll be the medical director." And actually, instead of me being the medical director, it was his girlfriend's dog.
Derek helped with the build out and was stunned by what he saw. Even before the clinic officially opened, people knocked on the door at night, peering into a half-finished construction site and asking if the doctor was in. "What is this place?" Derek thought. A few weeks later, he would become intimately familiar. His phone rang again. It was Chris. He asked if Derek could come to the clinic and just sit there for the day while he ran errands. The neighborhood made him nervous, Chris admitted. He didn't want to leave Diana there by herself. Before long, Derek was posted at the pain clinic every day, keeping watch for a few hundred bucks a shift. The clinic had barely been open for 3 weeks, but the crowds were already swelling beyond control, and the situation was about to get even crazier. Dr. William Overstreet, the only physician on staff at South Florida Pain, disappeared. He had collected his half of the week's profits, nearly $21,000, and left for a planned vacation but never returned. Days passed with no explanation. Finally, Overstreet's wife called to inform them that the doctor was never coming back. She explained that Overstreet had flipped his Jeep during a fishing trip in Panama and was found upside down, dead in a ditch. A tragedy, certainly, but for Chris George, it created an opportunity. Chris quickly realized that the identity of the doctor didn't matter, only their willingness to prescribe. The substitute physician Overstreet had arranged in his absence had already proven that much. So Chris placed a classified ad on Craigslist. MD with DEA license needed for busy pain clinic, make up to $400 an hour. The response was immediate, disturbingly so. He eventually hired Enoch Joseph, a 39-year-old gynecologist from Haiti, who agreed to be paid $75 per patient, plus a $1,000 weekly fee simply for the use of his DEA registration number. That was the new arrangement going forward. With Overstreet gone, Chris no longer had to split profits down the middle. The incentive structure shifted. The more patients a doctor saw in a day, the more money everyone made. And more doctors meant more DEA numbers. And more DEA numbers meant access to more pills. The only issue was that most pharmaceutical wholesalers had caps on the amount of controlled substances they would send to each doctor per week. Chris circumvented these restrictions by simply sourcing from multiple wholesalers, which was much easier than it should have been. All he had to do was fax in the doctor's registration number and medical license and tell them what he wanted. And what South Florida Pain Clinic usually wanted was a oxycodone, the cheaper, immediate release, easier to crush, dissolve, and inject alternative to OxyContin. The profit margin was obscene. South Florida Pain bought oxycodone for 33 cents per pill and sold them for $2. Every cent of profit from the pharmaceutical sales flowed straight into Chris George's pocket, and it was piling up faster than he had ever imagined. Within 2 months, the clinic was generating tens of thousands of dollars a day and growing exponentially. The billboards and back page ads Chris bought were paying off. Each morning before the doors even opened, a line of patients wrapped around the building. Most of them were from out of state, from places like Kentucky, Tennessee, and West Virginia, states that had implemented prescription monitoring programs to crack down on pill abuse. Florida had no such controls. Years earlier, Purdue Pharma had offered to help fund a statewide prescription monitoring database as part of a legal settlement, but the legislation to create it was blocked by then Florida House Speaker Marco Rubio in retaliation against a state senator who had hurt his feelings. Fast forward a few years, and caravans of pillbillies were traveling 1,000 miles down I-75 from Appalachia to South Florida, where one could visit as many doctors in a day as time allowed, not just to feed their addictions, but also to feed their families. Illegal $2 Roxy in Florida could be resold on the street in Morgantown for as much as $80. The trips were so profitable, the so-called sponsors would round up a vanload of people to make the trip, pay their appointment fees and prescription costs in exchange for half the goods. The locals would sometimes recruit patients from the free HIV clinic down the street. Everybody was welcome at South Florida Pain.
I'm like the fucking underboss here. I'm the one that gets called when shit needs to get done.
As a result, Derek Dolan's job of enforcing civility at the clinic grew more difficult by the day. Inside, he was in charge of bouncing patients who showed up with track marks on their arms or babies in their bellies. He had to stop people from robbing others who had passed out in their chairs or were convulsing on the floor. Outside, Derek was constantly running off people who were shooting up in their cars, pissing on the palm trees, or sucking and fucking behind the building.
Somebody called the cops and told them that there was a fight in the parking lot.
They don't stop, dude. They're like literally like a bunch of fucking toddlers.
The small parking lot in front of South Florida Pain was one of the most dystopian scenes in America, and that's saying something. Syringes rattled in soda cans. Neck braces and crutches were discarded behind the bushes. Zombie-like humans stumbled into neighboring businesses, asking to use the bathrooms. It was ugly. Even some of the doctors began carrying guns. It was only a matter of time before the spectacle at South Florida Pain drew public attention. On July 18, 2008, the Sun Sentinel ran a story with the headline, "Neighbors Calling Clinic a Pain." It's just been horrendous. The people hang out all day, a nearby bridal shop owner complained. The paper also quoted clinic owner Chris George, who insisted his operation, now serving as many as 100 patients a day, was making changes to ease neighborhood concerns, including renting additional parking spaces, all for the greater good, he said. Quote, "Pain is a big problem right now, and we're just doing our part." And South Florida Pain was doing its part by the book. A month earlier, the Florida Department of Health had conducted an unannounced inspection of the clinic and found only minor violations. The clean bill of health only emboldened Chris George. But after the article ran, the mood shifted. Police began circling the place like buzzards, Chris was even hauled off to jail one afternoon after confronting a cop who kept pulling over his customers. Then one of his doctors abruptly quit and opened a competing pain clinic down the street with her brother. To Chris, the message was clear. South Florida pain had worn out its welcome. It was time to move.
The following is a paid advertisement for the Swindle Valued Listener Rewards Program.
Are you tired of hearing advertisements in Swindle like this one? Do you wish there was more Swindle content to distract you from your miserable existence? Don't settle for those other inferior podcasts with the annoying hosts who laugh at their own jokes. Become a Swindle Valued Listener today to receive easy access to new episodes and exclusive access to bonus episodes that are not available anywhere else. Completely advertisement-free. It's fun for the whole family, but don't take our word for it.
I don't know where you people come from. I don't know if you test your products, your quantity of your products. Your products are very delicious. I don't mind paying you more money for your 16-ounce roll of sausage, but you don't have it anymore. You've got a 12-ounce roll. It ain't going to work, and I'm not going to purchase your product anymore or ever again. Goodbye. Son of a bitch. Somebody needs their ass kicked. Some little consumer geek alloy. Fuck this shit up. Save money, yeah, save money, save money. Fuck, I'm gonna eat, goddammit.
Millions of Swindled fans have discovered the secret of becoming a valued listener. Try it in your own home today. Also, act now to receive the Valued News for Valued Listeners update show at no extra cost. That's a $5,000 value for one easy monthly payment of $4.99.
Go to valuedlistener.com to sign up using Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Patreon. No long-term commitments, satisfaction guaranteed, foreign currency accepted. Cancel anytime. Please, just give us your money.
Broward County is the number one dispensing site for oxycodone in the entire country, according to DEA statistics. Doctors here handed out more than 3.3 million pills in just the first 6 months of the year. Palm Beach County and Miami-Dade rank second and third. But the problem for law enforcement is that what the clinics are doing is perfectly legal.
In August 2008, South Florida Pain Clinic temporarily relocated to a strip mall on Cypress Creek Road in Fort Lauderdale near I-95. The new location offered significantly more space and parking than the former bungalow on Oakland Park Boulevard, where Chris's girlfriend Diana Pavnik remained stationed to redirect patients to the new location. Chris himself was actively advertising job openings for new doctors to quickly fill the empty exam rooms. Again, there was no shortage of applicants. It seemed as if medical professionals from every specialty were looking to supplement their income, each for their own reasons. Family practitioners struggling to pay off student loans, proctologists drowning in gambling debt, Caribbean doctors who couldn't find a job anywhere else, and plastic surgeons whose business had dried up thanks to the recession. But in practice, there was only one qualification that mattered, the willingness to prescribe large quantities of controlled substances with minimal scrutiny. To find out, Chris had them shadow the existing physicians to observe how the clinic operated. The doctors at South Florida Pain never discussed their expected duty amongst themselves, perhaps for the sake of plausible deniability, but the reality was impossible to miss. The custom rubber stamps Chris had ordered to speed up prescription writing were a dead giveaway. If that wasn't enough, a quick stroll through the waiting room or the parking lot would tell them everything they needed to know. The same issues with controlling the patients persisted at South Florida Pain's new location. Within weeks, neighboring businesses were complaining about used needles turning up in their toilet bowls. The outrage was impossible to ignore. Chris decided something had to change. It was time to make the operation more legitimate, or at least appear more legitimate. In other words, the clinic needed to institute some additional hurdles to cover their own asses. He hired a law firm for $10,000 to draft a formal set of standard operating procedures, the kind any respectable medical practice would have. New requirements were introduced. Patients had to pass a drug test, and they had to submit MRI scans to justify their need for pain management. The new rules reduced some of the chaos. They also created new problems. The waiting room bathroom became unusable, clogged daily by patients flushing condoms in which they had smuggled clean urine. And the added bureaucracy gave rise to a new underground economy. Derek Nolan, already collecting bribes from patients desperate to skip the line, began earning thousands more through kickbacks from imaging centers in exchange for referrals. Ultimately, South Florida Pain entered into an exclusive partnership with a diagnostic company operating out of an unmarked trailer parked behind Goldfinger Gentlemen's Club. It stayed open late, the results were always worthy of narcotics, and the turnaround time was unmatched as well. Probably because the company didn't even waste time cleaning the MRI machine's headrest, which was caked with a thick brown ring of Appalachian dirt. South Florida Pain, too, had become a well-oiled machine, one that printed money, more than $250,000 a week. The cash came in so fast the registers couldn't contain it. 9-gallon garbage cans were placed under the desk and emptied multiple times throughout the day. There was a bit of an issue, however, with the money, that is. The banks wouldn't touch it, even though the business was above board and the income was reported. Financial institutions considered the cash suspicious and wanted nothing to do with it. The risk, they decided, wasn't worth the paperwork. So Chris George had to improvise. For a time, millions of dollars in cash had no home. Much of it ended up locked inside safes in the attic of his mother's house. Hundreds of thousands more were crammed into Abercrombie and Fitch shopping bags scattered around his own home. This eventually created another problem, because some of that money went missing. The list of suspects was short. Gino, Robbie, Hudson, or Jeff George, Chris's own twin brother. All four had been inside Chris's house for brunch one weekend in September 2008. A week later, someone climbed through a broken window in Chris's bathroom, and $500,000 vanished from a kitchen cabinet. Chris's initial suspicion fell on Jeff. The brothers were already at war. Jeff, who was in the process of opening his own pain clinics, had filed a lawsuit against Chris, alleging that South Florida Pain was his idea and that he was entitled to a share of the profits. Still, Jeff swore he hadn't taken the money. But Chris wanted proof, so he hired a polygraph examiner and put all four suspects through lie detector tests. Three passed. Robbie did not. And there would be hell to pay. Robbie Eddy was a lifelong scumbag who worked at South Beach Rejuvenation and actually lived with Jeff George. Once he emerged as the primary suspect, the twins set a trap. Jeff told Robbie they were going out on the boat and offered to lend him a pair of board shorts. He instructed Robbie to fetch them from his closet upstairs. Robbie walked through the house, into the bedroom, past the bare mattress on the floor, and toward the closet. When he turned around, Derek Nolan's fist was flying toward his face.
It was a punch slam combination type thing. Little poop came out. He pooped himself. He's wearing some jean shorts. It was smelly. Bounced off the wall. I picked him up, slammed him on his head. And I was like, damn. I smelt it first. And I was like, what the fuck? And Jeff's like, here, dude. He reaches behind his back and pulls out a pair of handcuffs. And he's like, cuff him. And I'm like, I got shit on me. All right. I cuff him. I go into the bathroom and I'm like washing myself. And I hear boom, gun go off.
Where's the money? Jeff screamed after firing three bullets into the floor next to Robbie's head, trying to force a confession. Robbie insisted he didn't know anything and begged them to stop. After a tense exchange, Jeff began to doubt that Robbie was responsible. Chris agreed. All right, let him go. What do you mean, let him go? Derek asked in a group huddle. We just kidnapped him and literally beat the shit out of this man. We can't let him go. We gotta kill him. The brothers disagreed. They decided the problem could be solved like any other, with money. Give him $10,000 and make him sign a document saying he won't turn us into the cops or something. So that's what they did. And months later, Robbie did exactly what Derek feared. After being arrested in an unrelated domestic violence incident, he told the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office about the kidnapping, along with everything else he knew about the George Brothers pill mills and steroid clinics.
Hey, UFA friends. Robbie Eddy here. Imagine overflowing abundance and a life flourishing beyond your wildest dreams.
Robbie Eddy, now a self-described reformed Christian, later confirmed the kidnapping episode in a 2021 memoir titled The Unfair Advantage. He denied stealing the $500,000 from Chris George, but did admit that he had once taken 10 grand from the center console of Jeff's truck. An act, he said, explained why he failed the polygraph test. Oh, and Robbie also confirmed in his book, for some reason, that he did, in fact, shit his pants.
We all crave blessings, but sometimes they trickle in like a leaky faucet, because God's got his blessings overflowing, ready to drench every corner of your life.
Chris George's missing money was never found.
Well, here's what we need today.
Carmel's on the case, only on 7 News.
They come from Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia to visit pain clinics like this one.
The appearance is that they are pill mills, simply handing drugs out hand over fist.
They come to buy pain pills by the hundreds from clinics that give out the dangerous narcotics.
We're talking hundreds of thousands of individuals trafficking into the state of Florida specifically to obtain pharmaceutical drugs.
And this is the kind of activity these pill mills generate. Right after getting some pills from a clinic, this man crushed some up, mixed them with a liquid, and then shot up in the clinic parking lot in the middle of a weekday afternoon.
After receiving a tip from a viewer, WSVN-TV's veteran investigative reporter, Carmel Caffaro, began stalking out South Florida Pain. For months, she watched the clinic, gathering footage and waiting for the right moment. On October 17, 2008, she made her move. In her trademark style of ambush reporting, Caffaro confronted staff as they arrived for work. She first caught Dr. Enoch Joseph walking from his car to the building. Derek Nolan stepped in immediately, blocking the camera and cutting off the exchange.
Are you certified in pain management? He would not answer questions about his pain clinic practice. Why do you think so many people are coming from out of state to see you here?
Because they're from the Bible Belt state and they can't get pain medication.
The man who answered would not give us his name, but did say he might be one of the owners of the clinic.
Moments later, Caffaro spotted Chris George outside the clinic and pressed him about the activity unfolding in the parking lot. Chris denied everything. Without answering further questions, he turned and retreated inside.
We have pictures of people snorting, shooting up in this parking lot after coming out of your clinic. I mean, what do you have to say about what's going on here?
I don't believe you're right.
That's all you have to say?
The segment that aired later that week was not as explosive as the station may have hoped, but the renewed attention did spell trouble for the clinic. A few weeks after the broadcast, agents from the DEA, the Florida Department of Health, and the Sheriff's Office arrived at South Florida Pain at 8 o'clock in the morning for another unannounced inspection. They combed through patient files, seized several thousand oxycodone pills, and questioned doctors and staff. 6 hours later, they left without making a single arrest, and the clinic reopened the same day. The visit did have consequences, however. Two physicians, including Dr. Joseph, were spooked enough to surrender their DEA registrations. For South Florida Pain, it was an inconvenience because those doctors would have to be replaced. But for Chris George, the lack of arrest was also vindication. It was becoming clear that law enforcement was focused solely on the doctors, not the owners. His attorneys, the state health department, and now even the DEA all seemed to agree on one thing. What Chris George was doing was illegal. He felt untouchable. But once again, the neighbors were fed up with the police cars, the news cameras, and the crowds. The building's owner even more so. South Florida Pain's lease was terminated, and once again, the operation was forced to move. Chris George treated the setback as another opportunity to upgrade. By then, the clinic was serving as many as 500 patients a day. He leased a 10,000 square foot suite in a Boca Raton strip mall, hired two additional physicians, including a young former Air Force emergency room doctor named Cynthia Cadet, and rebranded the business as American Pain. To further distance the operation from its unseemly reputation and its notorious owners, Chris installed a former police officer, Ethan Baumhoff, as office manager. Baumhoff handled the money, oversaw the supply chain, and became the clinic's public face. His name was placed on the company's registration documents. On paper, Chris George was no longer in charge. Meanwhile, Diana, Chris's girlfriend, was in charge of a second clinic Chris opened in West Palm Beach. It was called Executive Pain, and it functioned as a second chance for patients who had been turned away from American Pain. Chris wasn't about to let that money just walk out the door. Additionally, the day-to-day operations at Executive kept Diana occupied and away from the main office, allowing the boss to spend more quality time with his other female employees, allegedly.
I'm not answering any of your questions, but we need you guys to leave.
Can we come in and talk to the manager?
Yeah, you can't talk to anybody.
At Executive Pain Management in West Palm Beach, the bouncers won't talk, and like every other pain clinic we go to, the customers hide their faces.
One of those customers was Joey Bartolucci. Actually, he was one of Jeff George's customers at his new clinic called East Coast Pain. Joey was 24 years old and dreamed of becoming a paramedic, but he had dropped out of college and had recently lost his job, another casualty of an opioid addiction that left him missing shifts and spiraling out of control. On February 27, 2009, his girlfriend Amy reached a breaking point. She packed Joey's bags and told him to go stay with his mother. He needed help. Amy expected Joey to be out of their West Palm Beach apartment by the time she returned from work the next day. But when she texted him that afternoon, there was no reply. The night before, Joey had been slurring his words again, and he had been snoring loudly when she left that morning. Alarmed, Amy called Joey's best friend, Kenny, and asked him to do a welfare check. Amy feared that Joey may have overdosed. Kenny arrived to find Joey unresponsive in bed, the blankets neatly pulled up to his chin. On the nightstand sat two prescription pill bottles, filled just hours earlier by Dr. Gerald Klein, an 80-year-old pediatric surgeon working at East Coast Pain. The Palm Beach Post reported on Joey Bartolucci's death. He was among the first of more than 300 fatal overdoses recorded in Palm Beach County that year. Jeff George, never one to avoid the spotlight, offered a quote defending his role in the tragedy. "Unfortunately, the clinic and the doctor can't control a patient if they go home and do something stupid," he said. "I bought my Lamborghini 4 years ago. If I wreck it, am I going to hold the Lamborghini dealership responsible?"
Hello?
Hey, Mom. Hey, you might not be overly happy.
Oh, what happened, Chris?
Did you read the papers for us?
No.
He might have died of overdose. I went to Just Pain Clinic.
Later, in a phone conversation with his mother, Denise Haggerty, Chris George echoed his brother's indifference, dismissing Bartolucci as a, quote, loser. Denise offered reassurance to her son.
People have been overdosing for years,
she told him, before adding, "Oh well, it doesn't affect me." Chris George responded with the same apathy to another story the Palm Beach Post published later that year. On November 17, 2009, at 8:45 in the morning, the driver of a gold Toyota Camry with Tennessee license plates was leaving American Pain when she tried to weave through the lowered gates at a railroad crossing and was T-boned by a train. The car tumbled down the tracks, ejecting the 44-year-old driver and a 22-year-old passenger, both whom died at the scene. A third passenger, the 48-year-old husband of the driver, was pulled from the wreckage and died 6 months later. Derek Nolan read the article and called Chris.
You hear about our patients?
They tried to fucking weave through a railroad crossing and got hit by a fucking train yesterday.
What is that?
Two of them were dead, one of them was critical condition.
Did they say they were pain clinic people?
No, I didn't say it, but it will tomorrow. It will tomorrow that there was rocks scattered throughout the car.
Everybody's like exploded. I mean, they hauled on one and they both have gates and lights to go off. Like, you get hit by a train. You gotta be an idiot to get hit by a train.
You gotta be stupid to get hit by a train.
Chris George had no trouble sleeping at night. Like others throughout the pharmaceutical supply chain, he placed the blame squarely on the addicts. If people died, that was their own fault. Sure, I guess you could call it a tragedy, but it wasn't his responsibility. Besides, it's not like he wanted people to die from the product he was selling. Every cold body with a foam-filled mouth meant one less customer for American Pain. But that was the grim reality and the cost of doing business. Another day, another dollar, in a booming industry.
They are calling it an epidemic. Across the country, South Florida has become known as ground zero for people looking to score prescription drugs like OxyContin. Four new pain clinics opened in Palm Beach County just in the past week, and they're hungry for business.
But every 19 minutes,
someone overdoses on prescription drugs in America.
Addictive pills are so easy to get here that drug traffickers drive from states like Kentucky and West Virginia to load up on hundreds of legal narcotics that they then sell on the street.
We have more pill mills in Florida than any other state in this country. We have more pill mills in Broward County than McDonald's in Broward County.
Like, towards the end, we had 7 pain clinics, 3 steroid clinics,
okay,
and then like a few like telemarketing places doing like credit repair and the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
What else? That was pretty much all. My brother ended up buying a strip club.
Mm.
You know,
certainly.
At least
you have to.
And he started a massage parlor too.
On February 1st, 2010, American Pain relocated once again, this time to a 3-story former bank building on Dixie Highway in Lake Worth. It was the headquarters Chris George had always envisioned, tucked away in an industrial stretch he later described as being near Mexicans and little houses, which promised fewer complaints and less scrutiny. Chris, with his recently reconciled twin brother Jeff, also began looking to expand beyond Florida, where the state legislator had been discussing closing loopholes that allowed organizations like American Pain to exist. For the moment, though, business showed no signs of slowing. Revenues were approaching $500,000 per day. And the brothers' interests extended far beyond pain clinics. They were also involved in steroid operations, credit repair schemes, and timeshare marketing ventures, companies that regularly drifted into legally questionable territory. Chris had also purchased multiple pharmacies. Taken together, the network began to resemble a coordinated criminal enterprise. Ironically, that was exactly how law enforcement would have to pursue them. The pill mill itself, the big fish, wasn't technically breaking any laws. To shut it down, investigators would need to treat it as one piece of a larger, organized criminal scheme. For 14 months, a joint task force made up of the FBI, IRS, DEA, and local law enforcement had been quietly building a case against the George brothers. Undercover officers posed as patients inside American Pain, secretly recording what they saw. Investigators had also placed a wiretap on Chris George's phone and had been listening to his calls and reading his texts for months. By the morning of Wednesday, March 3, 2010, there was enough probable cause to make a move. Search and seizure warrants were issued for 7 locations. More than 400 officers coordinated a simultaneous raid on American Pain, Executive Pain, South Beach Rejuvenation, East Coast Pain, and the homes of Chris George, his mother Denise Haggerty, and American Pain's office manager, Ethan Baumhoff.
Hello? Christopher? Yes. Hey, it's the sheriff's office. What's wrong? You need to come home right now. Some people at your house need to speak to you.
When police arrived at Chris's house, no one was there. He had already left for the day on what he considered routine business involving a rival clinic. Chris had no intention of going back to his house. Instead, he began frantically calling anyone who might be implicated, starting with Diana, who volunteered to return to the property to scope out the scene. Chris would call her several times throughout the morning with regular updates and panic attacks.
Hello?
Hey.
Babe, I'm fucked. I have a search warrant for inside the house.
What?
Yeah.
For what?
I don't know. They're in the house. They have dogs there and FBI. It's not a fucking joke.
Call your lawyer right now, Chris.
You need to go there and switch one on. Listen, there's two guns in the garage. You're going to have to say those are yours or something.
I'll get rid of them.
Baby, you might have to take the blame for some of that stuff.
That's fine, Dave. Call your lawyer.
Babe, I think I'm in a lot of trouble.
In Chris's garage, the task force found 2 guns that were illegal for a felon like Chris to own. They were propped up against a wall that displayed a Nazi flag, which made sense. Chris had similar tattoos on his chest and abdomen. You never know who is living next door.
This is the home of Chris George. It's Jeff George's brother right behind me here. This is where he lived and operated out of. Curious neighbors said they never suspected anything. They said there was never any case for alarm. That wasn't until the bomb squad showed up.
The FBI, the DEA, the Special Forces, the bomb squad, you name it. I thought that Barack Obama himself was going to show up next. So,
inside, agents discovered what they believed to be an explosive compound. The bomb squad later determined that it was residue from homemade fireworks. They also seized $75,000 in cash from the house, but investigators knew it was only a fraction of what was hidden. Fortunately, Chris's still active wiretap led them straight to the rest.
Chris. Yeah, what's going on? It's DEA. They're at everybody's house, dude. Jeff, you need to go to our mom's house, dude. You know why? There's stuff in the attic, dude.
At the twins' mother's house, federal agents opened safes in the attic and found roughly $4.3 million in cash. Denise Haggerty insisted she had no idea it was there. Combined with 9 frozen bank accounts and the cash at the clinics, federal agents had seized over $7 million.
Wait, this isn't good at all. This isn't good at all. Okay. Fuck, dude. Where are you at?
I'm almost there. Yeah.
Babe.
Yes.
Dude, fuck. Dude. Dude, I don't know. I should just kill myself.
You need to relax, and you need to think of a plan.
I'm just gonna kill myself. Baby, you know I love you. Right.
Killing yourself is not the answer. You cannot leave me here by my fucking self to deal with your dirt.
What do you do?
I don't know, Chris. I don't know what you got us into.
Oh, baby, I'm fucked. I'm fucked, baby. Fuck.
Why are you fucked?
They're gonna put me in jail for a long time, babe. A long fucking time.
Well, early this morning, several federal agencies as well as a local agency swooped in to raid this American Pain Clinic as well as 2 others. They're owned by Wellington resident Jeff George.
The task force collected every computer and hard drive, the video surveillance systems, tens of thousands of patient files, and even the ATMs at the clinics. They handed every doctor a notice informing them that their DEA registrations had been suspended. Dude, it's over, Chris told Derek on the phone. It's a very good start to what is going to be a long process, Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw told the media, referencing the fact that no arrests had been made.
This case is going to show that every pill that was ordered and shipped to the Georgia's pain clinics was documented where it went out and documented properly. All their money was properly deposited, all the taxes were paid on everything. So I'm hoping that the paperwork that the government seized yesterday will back all of that up, and they'll see that these guys did their very best to run a legitimate enterprise, and hopefully we won't get an indictment.
More than 6 months passed after the raids, and still no charges were filed. Chris's attorney was confident the case would go nowhere, but advised Chris and Diana to marry anyway, just in case, so they wouldn't be forced to testify against one another. Chris also looked into opening an overseas bank account to protect what assets he still controlled, and he made a pact with Derek Nolan not to cooperate with investigators. They even commemorated it with matching tattoos, a rat hanging from a noose. Federal agents were unamused and called his bluff. In October 2010, they charged Chris George with unlawful possession of a firearm. He sat in jail for 8 months before agreeing to talk. By then, every doctor and staff member at American Pain had already folded. Derek Nolan followed suit. The result was a 123-page indictment, unsealed on August 23, 2011. 32 defendants, including Chris and Jeff, their mother, Denise, Derek, Diana, Ethan Baumhoff, and 13 doctors, were charged under RICO statutes, typically reserved for organized crime. Prosecutors alleged a sweeping criminal enterprise that ranged from online steroid clinics and telemarketing fraud schemes to a network of pill mills that issued nearly 67,000 illegitimate prescriptions for controlled substances that generated up to $40 million a year and contributed to an untold number of deaths. The indictment also made reference to kidnapping, extortion, unlawful restraint, and other crimes of violence. These defendants showed a callous disregard for the well-being of their patients and the value of human life, U.S. Attorney Wilfredo Ferrer said in a statement. This conduct, described in today's charges, is horrific. It's governed by absolute greed.
The FBI says today marks the dismantling of one of the nation's largest criminal organizations of illegal distributions of painkillers. And at the center of all of this is Jeff George, who will face murder charges in the death of a patient who overdosed on pain pills.
At the same time the federal indictment was announced, a state grand jury charged Jeff George, Dr. Gerald Klein and Theodore Obermeyer, the office manager at East Coast Pain, for their role in the death of Joey Bartolucci. George and Theo Obermeyer quickly pleaded guilty to state murder charges to avoid life sentences. Both men agreed to testify against Dr. Gerald Klein, who instead chose to go to trial. Klein was ultimately acquitted of the most serious charges, but he was convicted of illegally selling Xanax to Donald Trump's former chef. He was sentenced to 4 years of probation. Jeff George would learn his fate at the end of the federal proceedings, which would come sooner than later. 2 months after the indictment was unsealed, nearly every defendant had entered a plea. 25 of the twins' associates were sentenced to prison. Diana Pavnik and the twins' mother received 2.5 years for wire fraud. Derek Nolan got 14 years for racketeering conspiracy. Most of the doctors pleaded guilty to conspiracy charges as well and received 6-year sentences. Two of the older ones died before being handed their punishments. Two others refused plea deals and maintained their innocence. Dr. Cynthia Cadet, American Pain's Doctor of the Year in 2009, and Dr. Joseph Castro Nuovo of Executive Pain. Prosecutors filed a superseding indictment charging both doctors with more serious offenses, including distribution of controlled substances resulting in death. Their trial was scheduled for 2013. In the meantime, Chris George, the ringleader of the operation, pleaded guilty to racketeering and was sentenced to 17 and a half years in prison.
30-year-old pill mill operator Christopher George of Wellington has been sentenced to 17 and a half years in prison. He and his twin brother, Jeff George, authorities said, ran one of the largest illicit prescription drug networks in the nation, one that's blamed for at least 50 overdose deaths.
It was the longest sentence handed down in the case so far, until Jeff George, a competitive twin till the end, surpassed him with a 20-year state sentence for the murder charge. At the hearing, Jeff begged the judge for leniency, claiming he had already been severely beaten in prison for being a snitch. Speaking of which, nearly every defendant in the case was offered the chance to cut their prison stays in half by testifying against Cadet and Castro Nuovo in their upcoming trial. Cadet would ultimately argue that she had been an unwitting participant in the conspiracy, despite earning more than $1.2 million during 16 months at American Pain and an additional $1,000 a week prescribing steroids at South Beach Rejuvenation. Surprisingly, the jury agreed. On July 31, 2013, both Cadet and Castro Nuovo were acquitted of the drug and death charges, but convicted of money laundering. Cadet received the harsher sentence, 6.5 years in prison. As promised, nearly everyone who testified at trial received reduced sentences, except Derek Nolan, whom prosecutors deemed unhelpful on the stand. 11 years later, in 2022, Chris George walked out of prison, a free man.
And now that he's out of prison, in a new twist, Chris George is suing his former lawyer, claiming that man took $2 million of his money and took George's house.
While incarcerated, Chris claimed he hired attorney Jeffrey Siskind to protect his last remaining $2 million, money left over from his home construction business that he intended to place in a trust for his ex-wife Diana and their son. Instead, according to Chris, Siskind spent the funds on an office suite at Trump Plaza and membership dues at Mar-a-Lago. Chris also alleged that Siskind transferred ownership of his house to a company owned by the lawyer's father, who moved in and later died there at age 94. In 2025, following multiple complaints of financial misconduct, Jeffrey Siskind was permanently disbarred. No word on if Chris will ever recover those funds. That same year, a judge overturned Jeff George's second-degree murder conviction after ruling he had received ineffective legal counsel. He was resentenced to time served and released from prison after nearly 13 years. At the hearing, Jeff addressed the family of Joey Bartolucci and offered an apology.
I'm obviously deeply sorry for what happened. I regret my actions that caused this, and I'm just sorry for your pain every day. I hope it gets better.
Unfortunately, it hasn't gotten better. Every year, tens of thousands of people just like Joey Bartolucci die from synthetic and semi-synthetic opioids. Florida did eventually pass sweeping reforms that shut down its pill mills, like the ones the George brothers operated. As of 2023, every state in the country has implemented some form of prescription monitoring. But cutting off the supply of oxycodone didn't end the crisis. It just ushered in the next wave. The crackdown drove up the street value of prescription pills until heroin resurfaced as the cheaper, more lethal alternative. And that was before fentanyl entered the scene. It's become cliche at this point, but it bears repeating. Until the roots of addiction are addressed, the war on drugs will remain a never-ending exercise in futility. But maybe that's always been the point. To break them, medicate them, addict them, rehab them, jail them, bury them, blame them, and cash a check every step of the way. It's just further proof that there's nothing more profitable than American pain. Swindled is written, researched, produced, and hosted by me, a concerned citizen, with original music by Trevor Howard, aka Deformer, aka The Wise One. For more information about Swindled, you can visit swindledpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok at Swindled Podcast. Or you can send us a postcard at P.O. Box 2045, Austin, Texas 78768. But please, no packages. We do not trust you. Swindled is a completely independent production, which means no network, no investors, no bosses, no shadowy money men, no dirty headrest. And we plan to keep it that way, but we need your support. Become a valued listener on Patreon, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify at valuedlistener.com. For as little as $5 a month, you will receive early access to new episodes and exclusive access to bonus episodes that you can't find anywhere else. And everything is 100% commercial free. Become a valued listener at valuedlistener.com. Or if you want to support the show and need something to wear to Goldfingers, consider buying something you don't need at swindledpodcast.com/shop. There are t-shirts, patches, hats, hoodies, posters, coffee mugs, and more. swindledpodcast.com/shop. And remember to use coupon code CAPITALISM to receive 10% off your order. If you don't want anything in return for your support, you can always simply donate using the form on the homepage. That's it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Juliet from Atlanta.
Hi, I'm Hannah from the United Kingdom.
Hello, my name is Catherine from Clayton, North Carolina, and I am a concerned citizen and a valued listener. Everything's bad right now, but at least we'll get some great Swindled episodes out of the next 4 years, so that's good, right?